Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 170. It's Monday, July 4th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, recording this on July 4th, it doesn't feel much like Independence Day, considering that the Supreme Court recently overturned a half-century Roe versus Wade Supreme Court decision that has basically eliminated or put back to the states the right for reproductive health care choices for women, and I might add it's going to catch some men up in that as well. So I wanted to start off with just looking at the big picture here, looking at an abortion fact sheet from the World Health Organization. Around 73 million induced abortions take place worldwide each year. 6 out of 10, or 61% of all unintended pregnancies. And 3 of 10, 29% of all pregnancies end in induced abortion. Comprehensive abortion care is included in the list of essential health care services published by the World Health Organization in 2020. Abortion is a simple health care intervention that can be effectively managed by a wide range of health workers using medication or a surgical procedure. In the first 12 weeks of pregnancy, a medical abortion can also be safely self-managed by the pregnant person outside of a health care facility, for instance, at home, in whole or in part. This requires that the woman has access to accurate information, quality medicines, and support from a trained health worker if she needs or wants it during the process. Comprehensive abortion care includes the provision of information, abortion management, and post-abortion care. It encompasses care related to miscarriage or spontaneous abortion, induced abortion, the deliberate interruption of ongoing pregnancy by medical or surgical means, incomplete abortion, as well as fetal death. The information in this fact sheet focuses on care related to induced abortion. When carried out using a method recommended by WHO, appropriate to the pregnancy duration, and by someone with the necessary skills, abortion is a safe healthcare intervention. However, when people with unintended pregnancies face barriers to attaining safe, timely, affordable, geographically reachable, respectful, and non-discriminatory abortion, they often resort to unsafe abortion. Global estimates from 2010 to 2014 demonstrate that 45% of all induced abortions are unsafe. Of all unsafe abortions, one-third were performed under the least safe conditions, that is, by untrained persons using dangerous and invasive methods. Developing countries bear the burden of 97% of all unsafe abortions. More than half of all unsafe abortions occur in Asia, most of them in South and Central Asia. In Latin America and Africa, the majority, approximately 3 out of 4, of all abortions are unsafe. In Africa, nearly half of all abortions occur under the least safe circumstances. Each year, 5 to 13% of maternal deaths can be attributed to unsafe abortion. In developed regions, it's estimated that 30 women die for every 100,000 unsafe abortions. In developing regions, that number rises to 220 deaths per 100,000 unsafe abortions, or over 7 times higher. Estimates from 2012 indicate that in developing countries alone, 7 million women per year were treated in hospital facilities for complications of unsafe abortion. Multiple actions are needed at the legal, health system, and community level so that everyone who needs abortion care has access to it. The three cornerstones of enabling environment for quality comprehensive abortion care are respect for human rights, including a supportive framework of law and policy, the availability and accessibility of information, and a supportive, universally accessible, affordable, and well-functioning health system. Wonder what that might be. Let's see. A well-functioning health system implies many factors, including evidence-based policies, universal health coverage, a reliable supply of quality, affordable medical products and equipment, that an adequate number of health workers of different types provide abortion care at a reachable distance to patients, the delivery of abortion care through a variety of approaches, for example, care in health facilities, digital interventions, and self-care approaches, allowing for choices depending on the values and preferences of the pregnant person, available resources, and the national and local context. That health workers are trained to provide safe and respectful abortion care, to support informed decision-making, and to interpret laws and policies regulating abortion. That health workers are supported and protected from stigma, and provision of contraception to prevent unintended pregnancies in the first place. Availability and accessibility of information implies provision of evidence-based, comprehensive sexuality education and accurate, non-biased, and evidence-based information on abortion and contraception methods. Yikes. Well, folks, by that definition, we are very far away from a well-functioning healthcare system, particularly in regards to abortion and the availability and accessibility of information, particularly related to abortion and what is needed to prevent abortions, evidence-based comprehensive sexuality education, for instance. We are doing a very poor job in this country. Okay, so what happens when you criminalize healthcare? Let's look at this special report from MedPage Today. Doctors face unprecedented legal risks after Roe overturned. In the wake of the Supreme Court's ruling on Roe v. Wade, doctors across the country are facing an array of legal questions and concerns that are so new and uncertain they once seemed out of the realm of possibility, according to experts. From determining whether they can provide care when the life of the mother is at risk, and whether they must report a patient for a self-induced abortion, to considering how to code certain medical treatments and how to avoid allegations of aiding and abetting, doctors and other healthcare providers and staff are finding themselves caught in a precarious legal framework that is still in flux. It is a horrible situation to put doctors in who really just want to help patients, Jesse Hill of Case Western University School of Law in Cleveland. But at the same time, they have to abide by the law. The state-by-state complexities of trigger bans that went into effect once Roe was overturned have made matters exceedingly difficult for doctors, Hill and other experts said. Some trigger bans are being challenged, putting several states in legal limbo, while new laws that ban abortions in other states could pop up. Additionally, state legislatures could move immediately or in the coming months to make anti-abortion laws even stricter, threatening access to contraception and in vitro fertilization. All the while, the laws have been and continue to be written by politicians, not physicians, experts noted. And because enactment and enforcement of the laws are unprecedented, there isn't an existing branch of law dedicated to helping doctors and other healthcare professionals navigate them. What is certain, however, is that the stakes are incredibly high for physicians who can face losing their licenses, as well as felony charges and substantial prison time for a variety of newly minted, rapidly changing, and often vague laws. Healthcare has so many rules and so many regulations, Hill said, but most healthcare rules and regulations don't carry criminal penalty. From state to state, potential penalties can be leveled for anything from directly providing an abortion to simply providing a phone number to a woman seeking medical care. As physicians grapple with this new scrutiny, experts are certain their patients will suffer greatly as well. I think it is really going to chill the provision of care, Hill noted. Experts detailed a handful of areas that doctors will need to seek legal guidance or counsel for in the days and months ahead. There will undoubtedly be more to come, as well as many intricacies under each category. This is such a shift in the law and the framework that we've all been grounded in for such a long time, Katie Keith of Georgetown University Law Center in Washington, D.C. said. People could always practice medicine in the way that they needed to. Now doctors are going to be looking over their shoulders and second-guessing what they're doing. One critical question involves saving the life of the mother. How is that being defined, and how broadly or narrowly can physicians interpret it in the states that ban abortions but allow for such an exception? How ill can someone have to be, Keith questioned. Conditions can range from preeclampsia to ectopic pregnancies. One potential loophole may be the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, a federal law enacted in 1986, Keith noted. This law requires emergency departments that receive Medicare or Medicaid funding to stabilize patients. At the same time, Due to uncertainty surrounding the new laws, doctors may have to question whether to help a pregnant woman who is losing massive amounts of blood and whether to treat a woman who has been diagnosed with cancer and needs to terminate her pregnancy in order to start chemotherapy. My concern is that doctors will feel constrained and that it will have a chilling effect and that women who should qualify will not be getting care, she added. Another area of concern is miscarriage management, experts said, such as the treatment of patients experiencing incomplete miscarriages with medication or a procedure. Keith wondered if doctors will feel uncomfortable providing that care, pushing women to travel to another state. Physicians and other providers will also be faced with situations in which a pregnant woman's fetus has been found to have a fatal defect, experts noted. This is just so devastating, Miranda Yaver, an assistant professor of political science at Wheaton College, said. Imagine a patient having to carry a fetus to term that is not going to be able to survive. Furthermore, healthcare providers may be unsure of whether they must report patients who are experiencing abortion complications or who have attempted to induce their own abortions. Oftentimes, a provider may think they're required to report something when they're not, she added, which can become a real problem for patients. Is this going to hinder patients' ability to have healthy communication with providers? Perhaps one of the most vague aspects of some state laws is aiding and abetting, experts noted. There's often a very hazy line between what is First Amendment-protected counseling and what is aiding and abetting. Causes for concern can be as simple as making a referral, Keith pointed out. We're in uncharted waters. Another looming question is whether states can restrict access to or ban the FDA-approved drug for medication abortion, noting that medication abortion will be an important area to watch from a legal perspective. Keith further said that doctors will face questions regarding how reproductive care gets coded in medical records, as well as whether certain restrictions are placed on out-of-state telemedicine providers. And if states move to include language in their laws that specifies that life begins at the moment of fertilization, there could be an additional range of legal concerns for physicians and other providers. Thomas Berwinkle, a reproductive endocrinologist in Cincinnati, Ohio, noted that he posed the following question to the legislative committee in the Ohio House. If a lab's liquid nitrogen storage tank breaks and all the embryos that are stored there are lost, will physicians and staff be criminally prosecuted? It's a very slippery slope, he said, of proposed legislation in Ohio. I'm having a hard time recruiting embryologists into the field. There will be many infertile patients who will not be able to get services they need, he pointed out. Ultimately, abortion is the beginning, not the end, Yaver said. This is really foreshadowing broader concerns about contraceptive access. Some people on the right characterize Plan B and IUDs as abortive. Millions of patients rely on these contraceptive methods, she noted. These gray areas are going to hurt providers, and they're going to hurt patients. Making matters all the more complicated, many doctors and clinicians may not have a ready Rolodex of legal advisors available on demand. However, answers to what care physicians can provide are needed at a moment's notice, and the network of new state laws is evolving just as fast. It's not clear that there is an obvious answer to who doctors and other healthcare providers can turn to. If they are employed by a relatively large institution, such as a hospital or healthcare system, providers will look to their hospital policy or legal counsel. This is the twin danger of laws like this, Hill noted. They make doctors worry about liability. So if they can't readily access legal advice, they are probably going to take the conservative approach. They also encourage hospital legal departments to put guidance in place to protect themselves. The people who have the expertise here are criminal defense lawyers who are likely to be called upon for help before and after the fact, she said. We have to be honest with ourselves, Leela J. Levi, Senior Counsel for Reproductive Rights and Health at the National Women's Law Center in Washington, D.C., said, of the legal and medical community. There are things we can't know and don't know. However, there are many lawyers, pro bono and otherwise, who would be available for physician or other provider to defend a medical decision that they have made in consultation with the patient, she said. Though it is not a unique problem, it is certainly exacerbated post-Roe, she noted. Physicians have long operated with medical malpractice insurance, but what the field is dealing with now is criminalization, and that landscape is changing minute by minute. Levi said that the National Women's Law Center and other organizations would likely take some cases on a case-by-case basis, noting that she is most concerned about the effects that the ruling and resulting state trigger laws will have on the provision of care. Levi emphasized that it's not just physicians who will be affected by the new laws. The impact will extend to nurses and administrative staff at healthcare facilities. Think about the person who answers the phone at a clinic, who has to tell the patient that it is not providing care, she said. That same person may also have to question whether they can provide a phone number to another facility for fear of legal ramifications. Berwinkle also noted that in addition to OB-GYN and fertility providers, emergency medicine physicians will be on the front lines, as will psychiatrists and psychologists handling trauma from unwanted pregnancies and other factors. When it comes to how enforcement of new state laws may play out, Hill described an example of a woman's partner or family member being unhappy about abortion-related care she received and reporting it. It's also possible that healthcare professionals may be reported by their colleagues for providing certain care or services, experts said. Overall, Hill noted that she thinks enforcement is going to be uneven, capricious, and arbitrary. Yaver said she believes the Supreme Court's decision is going to have far-reaching effects on relationship between patients and their providers, and between relationships between providers and states, all to the detriment of people's lives. Where physicians select to establish their practice is going to deepen the health disparities between red states and blue states, she added. Levy pointed out that when a patient is sick or in a precarious medical state, having to include politicians or lawyers in deciding what is the best course of care, it is not only dangerous, but insulting. It's an attack on both the dignity of the patient and the provider, she said. Amen. And amidst that legal morass, this also from MedPage Today, standardize abortion education across U.S. medical schools. A recent U.S. Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade will undoubtedly restrict the reproductive health care that many physicians can provide. Critically, it will also threaten the clinical knowledge and skills of the next generation of physicians. As medical students, we firmly believe that any comprehensive reproductive health education includes abortion. More than 800,000 surgical and medication abortions are performed in the U.S. each year, making it one of the most common surgical procedures performed on women in the U.S. and a growing part of medication management within a range of specialties, from family medicine to psychiatry. Thus, foundational knowledge of the physical and psychosocial effects of abortion is imperative for all physicians in training, regardless of their intended specialty. This training is especially crucial now as the future of abortion provision faces an existential threat. Researchers expect the proportion of OB-GYN residents with access to abortion training to drop from 92% to at most 56% post-Roe. Most of these physicians will go on to practice in the same state where they completed residency training, meaning that over time, provider losses will be concentrated in states that ban or severely restrict abortion. This will further exacerbate access disparities, which already disproportionately harm marginalized populations. While there is a heightened need for comprehensive reproductive health education in the wake of Roe being overturned, abortion curricula, even as they stand now, are inconsistent and limited across U.S. medical schools. In 2020, researchers found that half of medical schools included no formal training or only one lecture on the topic. OB-GYN residency programs have attempted to rectify this disparity by standardizing abortion education in graduate medical education. However, this solution only reaches a fraction of all residents whose patients need abortion care. Medical student advocacy organizations like the Medical Students for Choice have been instrumental in expanding abortion curricula within undergraduate medical education thus far. However, systemic action remains necessary. Implementing a universal curricular standard across U.S. medical schools would rectify current educational disparities, ensuring that all medical students have the opportunity to learn about abortion in clinical practice from indications to management. Remember, folks, abortion care is health care. And this from Axios. Next, post-Roe battlefield, online abortion information. Conservative activists have won their goal of being able to criminalize abortion, are now aiming to limit or ban online information sharing on the topic. What's driving the news? In the wake of the Supreme Court's Dobbs ruling overturning Roe v. Wade, tech platforms are already struggling to moderate abortion-related content and fight misinformation around the topic. Why it matters. Those seeking to share information online about abortion, whether it's about the procedure itself or where to legally access it, will be in the crosshairs of restrictive state laws and changing social media policies. Since the court overturned Roe, experts have feared private data could incriminate online users. Now, publicly shared information can be in danger as well. Confusion reigns about what can and can't be said about abortion in different online spaces. Motherboard reported Monday that Facebook is removing the posts of users who shared status updates that say abortion pills can be mailed, and in some cases temporarily banning those users. Meta, whose policies prohibit people from purchasing and selling non-medical drugs, pharmaceutical drugs, and marijuana on the platform, said some posts were incorrectly removed. Shout Your Abortion, a campaign that promotes abortion access and education, posted this week that Instagram was putting sensitive material warnings on posts mentioning abortion pills, or criticizing the Supreme Court's decision. Instagram tweeted it was looking into sensitivity labels being incorrectly used. What they're saying: we are worried about censorship. We have been censored by social media sites already, Elisa Wells, director of Plan C, a website with information about medication abortion, told Axios. We have a right to free speech to put this information out there. But we're still preparing for additional shutdowns of the flow of information about access to abortion pills, she said. We're at a point where so many people are sharing information that it becomes sort of unstoppable. Is there something on a platform that makes it look like a platform is facilitating criminal behavior? Then we'll have to take that seriously, Matt Perrault, former head of global policy development at Meta, now director of the University of North Carolina Center on Technology Policy, told Axios. But platforms will also be under pressure to not silence facilitation of people seeking abortions in ways that are legitimate. Misinformation is a problem, too. New York Attorney General Letitia James, a Democrat, wrote to Google this week asking the company to correct search results directing people seeking abortions to, quote, dangerous and misleading anti-abortion clinics in New York on Google Maps. Online claims about abortion pills making women infertile or being deadly proliferate on online forums. Videos promoting unsafe methods of herbal abortion are popular on TikTok, Rolling Stone reported. Beyond social media platforms' crackdown, conservative legislatures may pass laws criminalizing online speech about abortion on websites and internet services. New anti-abortion model legislation from the National Right to Life Committee could put reporters writing about abortion information and anyone sharing information online about abortion at risk, news outlet Prism First reported early this week. That model legislation, which the organization encourages states to adopt, would criminalize aiding and abetting an illegal abortion via instructions on the internet and hosting or maintaining a website that encourages or facilitates effort to obtain an illegal abortion. I will just state that as a reporter on this show, I have no intention of not reporting on this information, and I will continue to do so. Already, Texas anti-abortion law SB 8 enables individuals to sue any person or institution for facilitating abortions, which free speech advocates have said has chilling effects and creates fear of litigation for sharing information about abortion online. These laws could violate both First Amendment and Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which largely shields websites from liability for what their users post online. The bottom line: in an environment that's increasingly hostile to First Amendment rights, neither governments nor private companies are in a strong position to protect online speech. Some advocates say the Supreme Court's decision and subsequent action by state legislatures are a wake-up call to maintain strong legal free speech protections at the national level, like Section 230, which has come under fire from critics of big tech. Rather than spending tens of millions of dollars fighting in court, many online platforms will instead race to the bottom and comply with the most restrictive state laws, Evan Greer and Leah Holland of digital rights group Fight for the Future wrote in a Wired op-ed. Okay, well, I have a bunch more abortion-related stories that I will cover on the articles that are available online later in the show. In other devastating Supreme Court news, this from Associated Press: Supreme Court limits EPA in curbing power plant emissions. In a blow to the fight against climate change, the Supreme Court last Thursday limited how the nation's main anti-air pollution law can be used to reduce carbon dioxide emissions from power plants. By a 6-3 vote, the conservatives in a majority, the court said that the Clean Air Act does not give the Environmental Protection Agency broad authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from power plants that contribute to global warming. The court's ruling could complicate the administration's plan to combat climate change. Its detailed proposal to regulate power plant emissions is expected by the end of the year. Though the decision was specific to the EPA, it was in line with the conservative majority's skepticism of the power of regulatory agencies, and it sent a message on possible future effects beyond climate change and air pollution. President Joe Biden aims to cut the nation's greenhouse gas emissions in half by the end of the decade and to have an emissions-free power sector by 2035. Power plants account for roughly 30% of carbon dioxide output. United Nations spokesman Stephanie Dujarric weighed in to call the decision, quote, a setback in our fight against climate change when we are already far off track in meeting the goals of the Paris Agreement, the International Climate Accord that the U.S. left during the Trump administration and re-entered once Biden took office. Richard Revez, an environmental expert at the New York University School of Law, called the decision a significant setback for environmental protection and public health safeguards. Senator Democratic leader Chuck Schumer of New York said the consequences of Thursday's decision will ripple across the entire federal government, from the regulation of food and drugs to our nation's healthcare system, all of which will put American lives at risk.
Okay, well, next up we have a story that leads to interesting context of the ability or not the ability to support families in this country. This from the New York Times. New guidelines encourage breastfeeding longer, but call for more parental support. The American Academy of Pediatrics issued a policy statement last Monday that extends the period of time for which breastfeeding is recommended to 2 years or more, but that also acknowledges the obstacles that stand in parents' way. We need societal changes that will help us support this, such as paid leave, more support for breastfeeding in public, and childcare facilities and workplace support, said Dr. Joan Meek, professor emeritus in the Department of Clinical Sciences, the Florida State University College of Medicine, and lead author of the new recommendations. Much of the policy, the group's first updated guidance on breastfeeding in a decade, is identical to what the Academy has said in the past. The organization continues to recommend that babies be exclusively breastfed for about 6 months, at which point complementary foods can be introduced. The statement cites research linking breastfeeding to a range of benefits in infants, including decreased rates of lower respiratory tract infections, severe diarrhea, and ear infections. But the group is now calling for pediatricians to support breastfeeding for 2 years or more instead of 1 year or more, if mutually desired, by mothers and their babies. Dr. Meek said the shift was rooted in research that suggests there are particular health benefits of extended breastfeeding for mothers, like decreased type of maternal type 2 diabetes. But it also reflects the American Academy of Pediatrics' desire to normalize breastfeeding for longer for parents who choose to do it. In the medical community, there has often been this tendency to support breastfeeding up until a child's first birthday, Dr. Meek said. After that, it's like, well, there's no reason to continue breastfeeding. The reality, however, is that a majority of American babies are not breastfed for as long as the Academy recommends. Its new policy statement is in line with guidance from the World Health Organization, which has long endorsed breastfeeding up to a child's second birthday or past it. The most recent data available from the CDC says 84% of babies start out being breastfed, but only 58% are breastfeeding at 6 months, and just 25% are breastfed exclusively. 35% of babies are still breastfed at 1 year, and there are not reliable estimates beyond that time frame. The gulf between public health guidelines and what happens in most American families can leave new parents vulnerable to feelings of guilt or disappointment. This is the recommendation, but in actuality, in practice, we don't want parents to feel bad if they can't get there. The Academy's new breastfeeding policy statement acknowledges that many of the barriers parents face in meeting public health recommendations and their own goals are beyond their control. It encourages pediatricians to advocate changes that could help parents, including guaranteed paid leave, flexible work schedules, and workplace resources like lactation rooms, universal break time for pumping breast milk, and on-site child care. I'm going to read that again. It encourages pediatricians to advocate changes that would help parents, including guaranteed paid leave, flexible work schedules, and workplace resources like lactation rooms, universal break time for pumping breast milk, and on-site child care. Wow, there's a dream. Make it so. Okay, next up, another story on pediatrics. This is from Helio. Race unexplored in most pediatric clinical care guidelines, review finds. Race and ethnicity are unexplored in most American pediatric clinical practice guidelines published in the last 5 years, according to results of a systematic review published in JAMA Pediatrics. Courtney Gillum, a member of the Division of Hospital Medicine in the Department of Pediatrics at Seattle Children's Hospital and co-author of the review, said in a Helio interview that the use of race in clinical practice guidelines has the potential to positively or negatively affect structural racism and health inequities. We knew that medicine has a very long history of applying blame to the biology and genetics of race, and we wanted to look at the guidelines to see if racism is seeping through into our gold standard, Gillum said. Additionally, we really wanted to look at how to shift the focus of talk about racism as the reason for observed differences, not race. I'd like to repeat that. We need to talk about racism, not race. This is something I've tried to improve in my reporting because I'm reading a lot of other stories that are written by other folks, and sometimes I make editorial changes, but we really need to stop talking less about race and more about racialized populations because race is a human construct. It's not a biological construct. Okay, on with the story. The researchers also found that when race or ethnicity was mentioned, 57% of the time it was used in a way that could exacerbate or have negative impact on inequities, and only 15% of clinical practice guidelines include language specifically intended to address disparities in medicine. In all, 70% of the guidelines did not mention race or ethnicity at all. I think that shows a missed opportunity for us as medical organizations to be proactive in talking about healthcare inequities and systemic racism in our field, Gillum said. We have a long way to go in interrogating clinical practice guidelines. What needs to come next, Gillum said, includes a shift in the language of these reviews and a move away from race as a variable between the difference in health outcomes and looking at the systemic factors we have to overcome. We also need to take a look at who is on the committees when we're building these guidelines. We should be taking a look to see if we have representation from all parties. Are we thinking with a lens of equity? Are we taking into account social determinants of health? Racism still exists in medicine, and it's seeping into our standards of care, Gillum said. We need to think about why we're communicating it this way and start breaking down that barrier. And speaking of health effects in disenfranchised populations, this from Kaiser Health News. Overdose deaths behind bars rise as drug crisis swells. The alcohol and drug overdose death rate increased fivefold in prisons from 2009 through 2019, according to a recent study from the Pew Charitable Trust, a surge that outpaced the national drug overdose rate, which tripled in that same period. As the opioid crisis ravages America, overdose deaths are sweeping through every corner of the nation, including jails and prisons. Criminal justice experts suggest that decades of using the legal system instead of community-based addiction treatment to address drug use have led to a drop in drug use or overdoses. Instead, the rate of drug deaths behind bars in supposedly secure facilities has increased. This rise comes amid the decriminalization of cannabis in many parts of the country and a drop in the overall number of people incarcerated for drug crimes, according to the Pew report. It certainly points to a need for alternative solutions that rely less on the criminal justice system to help people who are struggling with substance use disorders, said Tracy Velasquez, a senior manager for safety and justice programs at the Pew Charitable Trust. The researchers found that fewer than 8% of arrested people with drug dependency received treatment while incarcerated. A lot of drug use is spurred by people with mental health issues attempting to self-medicate. Almost 40% of people in prisons and 44% in jails have a history of mental illness, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics. They don't put the mental health patients where they should be. They put them in prison. We need to really focus on not assuming that putting someone in jail or prison is going to make them abstinent from drug use. We really need to provide treatment that not only addresses the chemical substance abuse disorder, but also addresses some of the underlying issues. A lot of the people that are dying, I would argue, don't belong in prison. What's so disgusting about all this is we are sentencing people who are drug addicted to time in these so-called correctional facilities when we're really just throwing them into drug dens. In contrast, California reported a 60% reduction in overdose deaths in its prisons in 2020, which state officials attributed to the start of a substance use treatment program and the widespread availability of medication-assisted therapy. Though prison officials have long blamed visitors for bringing in drugs, the ban on visitation during the pandemic did not lead to a drop in drug use inside. Multiple officers were arrested in Alabama last year and accused of bringing drugs into jails and prisons, and the Department of Justice's 2019 report found dozens of officers arrested in the previous 2 years on charges related to drug trafficking and other misconduct. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT We Act Radio, 106.1 FM Toledo. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, I want to do a follow-up to a story I did last week about the Biden administration starting the long process to reduce nicotine levels in cigarettes down to non-addictive levels. This is an opinion piece and editorial from the LA Times. Drastically reducing nicotine levels will save a lot of lives. Nicotine kills. Oh, not directly for the most part. It's just so addictive that cigarette smokers find it nearly impossible to quit a product that subtracts years off their life, causes cancer, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, strokes, and heart disease, along with worsening type 2 diabetes. In 2018, more than half of the smokers in this country tried to stop. Only 8% did. The United States banned enticing candy flavors and raised the smoking age in an effort to keep kids from getting hooked on cigarettes, with some success. But there's still many teens and adults who are hooked and unable to rid themselves of a habit they probably started when they were too young to know better. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has wanted to reduce nicotine levels in cigarettes since the 1990s, but now it has an administration willing to back the idea. President Biden is proposing to slash nicotine levels of cigarettes to minimal or non-addictive levels. The tobacco industry long played with the nicotine levels in cigarettes to make them more addictive, regardless of the suffering and premature death they cause. So it only makes sense for the FDA, charged with regulating nicotine levels under the Tobacco Control Act of 2009, to take things in the opposite direction. The nicotine plan is expected to take years to happen, and many obstacles could stand in the way. Changes in administration, intense lobbying by the industry, interference by Congress, and court challenges. But for the sake of millions of Americans addicted to cigarettes, we hope that the FDA prevails. Reducing the nicotine that creates a physiological addiction to smoking would likely be far more effective than banning candy flavors or menthol, which the FDA is also considering. Raising cigarette taxes, or any of the other steps taken so far. People who want to quit would have a fighting chance. The tobacco industry is opposed to the plan, of course, and claims that if nicotine levels are lowered, smokers will inhale more deeply or smoke more cigarettes to get their nicotine fix. Research has proved this wrong. A study published in May showed that cravings for cigarettes are lower when the nicotine content in them is drastically reduced, and curtailing the nicotine sharply is far more effective than doing it gradually for people trying to quit, various studies have shown. The industry advocates instead for, quote, harm reduction, which essentially means getting people hooked on electronic cigarettes instead of the combustible version. It's not difficult to guess what its real objection to nicotine reduction is: losing revenue from the millions of Americans currently hooked on the number one cause of premature death. And if you yourself or somebody you know who's interested in quitting smoking, you can call the Ohio Smoking Quit Line, Tobacco Quit Line, at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. That's 1-800-QUIT-NOW for resources on quitting smoking. Now on to another public health issue, traffic deaths. This from Science Daily. Up to 540,000 lives could be saved worldwide by targeting speed and other main areas of prevention. A new series published in The Lancet highlights a growing problem of road traffic injuries and lays out some opportunities for preventing injuries and saving lives. The series came at the same time as the United Nations General Assembly launched a high-level meeting on global road safety. The series offers a comprehensive analysis of that rising public health threat. An estimated 1.3 million people worldwide lose their lives, and more than 50 million are injured or disabled as a result of road traffic injuries every year. And this is the number one leading cause of death worldwide for ages 5 to 29. Researchers studied four road safety risk factors: speed, drunk driving, helmet, and seatbelt use. They found that full implementation of already proven road safety interventions targeting those four main areas could save up to 540,000 lives around the world each year. In the United States, a total of 43,000 lives could be saved by focusing on those four road safety areas, including more than 22,000 lives saved by restricting speed and more than 5,100 with interventions on drunk driving. Another 14,000 could be saved by better use of seatbelts and 2,400 lives saved by using helmets. So the bottom line here is 84% of potential lives saved from road traffic changes could be done through restricting speed and using seatbelts. So it's not some great new technology or method. It's been around for a long time. Speed kills, and not using a seatbelt leads you to a greatly increased chance of severe injury or death. And next up, highlighting how we're not doing such a great job on that front of medical crashes, this from Medical Express. United States has highest motor vehicle crash mortality rate in 2019. The United States has higher population-based, distance-based, and vehicle-based motor vehicle crash death rates compared with other high-income countries, according to a research published by the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. The researchers found that in 2019, the United States had the highest population-based death rate among the 29 high-income countries, which was 2.3 times the average rate of the other 28 countries. This population death rate in the United States for traffic deaths is 11 per 100,000 population, and translated to Lucas County's population, that'd be about 50 deaths a year. The 2019 U.S. distance-based death rate was 21% higher than the average rate among 20 other countries. From 2015 to 2019, the population base death rate increased 0.1% in the United States, whereas the average change in the other 27 high-income countries was down 10%. So while we're staying the same, the other high-income countries are actually improving their safety on the roads. So one of the big things here about our culture is that we travel a lot more miles. So we're a little bit higher, 21% higher per mile, but when you add it up all together, we're driving a lot more miles So it's a lot higher here than in other industrialized countries. Okay, well, let's switch to some COVID reporting. First from Medical Express. World Health Organization says COVID-19 cases rising nearly everywhere in the world. The number of new coronavirus cases rose by 18% in the last week, with more than 4 million cases reported globally, according to the World Health Organization. The WHO director said cases were on the rise in 110 countries, mostly driven by the Omicron variants BA4 and BA5. And on the U.S. home front, this from Stat News, FDA recommends vaccine makers update COVID-19 shots to target Omicron. The Food and Drug Administration is advising vaccine makers to reformulate their COVID-19 shots to target the BA4 and BA5 Omicron subvariants, as well as the original strain of the virus, the agency announced last Thursday, as it seeks to provide people with broader protection against the evolving coronavirus. The BA4 and BA5 variants of Omicron, which have identical forms of the virus's spike protein that the vaccines are designed to treat, together now account for the majority of infections in the United States and have been building in prevalence globally. The FDA had to provide its adaptation this summer so that vaccine makers have enough time to adapt their formulas and manufacture shots should a fall and winter booster campaign be necessary. The two-component shot is known as a bivalent vaccine. So this just affects booster shots. If you're getting an original series, if you've never been fully vaccinated, they're still using the original formulations for that. And in some COVID-19 health disparity reporting, this from Science Daily, analysis shows that Black and Hispanic mothers bore the greatest burden. The COVID-19 pandemic and its impacts have taken a disproportionate toll on American mothers who were pregnant or just gave birth. Maternal mortality, that is deaths during the pregnancy or in the early post-pregnancy period, increased by 18% in 2020, according to data from the National Center for Health Statistics. That exceeded the 16% increase in overall U.S. mortality in 2020. Yet according to a new analysis from the University of Maryland and Boston University, the maternal death rate after the start of the COVID-19 pandemic was even higher and disproportionately impacted Black and non-white Hispanic mothers. A research letter published in JAMA Network Open compared maternal mortality data from 2018 through March 2020 before the pandemic to April through December 2020. Overall, they found large increases in maternal deaths, 33%, and late maternal deaths, 41%, after March 2020, compared with before the pandemic, and conspicuous increases among Black and Hispanic mothers. The increase was really driven by deaths after the start of the pandemic, which was higher than what we see for overall excess mortality in 2020. The study also showed that existing and new disparities emerged after the pandemic, with a 40% jump among already high rates for non-Hispanic Black women and a 74% jump among formerly lower rates in Hispanic women. Strikingly, for the first time in more than a decade, the maternal mortality rate for Hispanic women during the pandemic was higher than that for non-Hispanic white women, a shift that may be related to COVID and deserves greater attention moving forward. COVID-19 was listed as a secondary cause of death in 15% of maternal deaths in the last 9 months of 2020, and with it being a contributing factor for 32% of Hispanic, 13% of Black, and 7% of non-Hispanic white women giving birth. In their analysis of causes of maternal death, they found the largest increases were due to conditions directly related to COVID-19, such as respiratory or viral infection, and conditions made worse by COVID-19 infection, such as diabetes or cardiovascular disease. Also, interruptions to the healthcare system could have led to delayed prenatal care that could have meant the risk factors for pregnancy complications went undetected or were detected late. Okay, well, what's happening in Lucas County and Ohio with COVID-19? Well, Lucas County, according to the CDC's categorization, is at the medium level. And now that the BA4 and BA5 is dominant, we're seeing that rise. So it looks like we're getting a little bit of a bump after the decrease of the other variants. The Lucas County average daily number of cases went down slightly to 58 a day, identified from 62 in the previous week. But of course, these rates are not very reliable, and probably that true number of infections is many, many, many times higher, probably 10 or 12 times or more higher. The testing positivity rate did go up in Lucas County, up to about 10%, from about 8% in the previous week. And in Ohio as well, it went up to 14 or 15% from about 12 or 13% in the previous week. And in the U.S., it went up as well to 15.3% from 14.2% in the previous week. Now, you'll notice I'm using ranges like 14 to 15% and stuff because there's been a lag in reporting, and it hasn't been as accurate from a recent time period. So you have to do a little bit more of approximation there. And of course, the big story, I suppose, is for this is the testing level in the U.S. continues to drop, setting new lows as far as testing volumes. Only had lower levels in the very beginning of the pandemic when testing was extremely limited. That was limited because we didn't have tests. This is limited because people just aren't taking them. Okay, well, in long-term care facilities, nursing homes, we had the exact same number, 82 active cases that we did the previous week before. Fortunately, no new deaths. Hospitalizations in the U.S. continue to rise slowly, although it does look like the slope has turned upward, which means it's accelerating. And this is consistent with the rise in deaths that we're seeing. Deaths nationally are rising again, and we're at over 380 per day, which on an annual basis, for perspective, would be 139,000 deaths per year. Okay, let's do a few healthcare stories. This first one from Medical Express. Privatizing national health services associated with decline in quality of healthcare, increasing deaths from treatable causes. Outsourcing Britain's National Health Service services to the private sector is associated with reduced quality of patient care and increased rate of deaths from treatable causes, according to analysis published in the Lancet Public Health Journal. Findings from the study suggest increased privatization of health services in England between 2013 and 2020 was linked to higher rates of treatable mortality, deaths considered avoidable with timely, effective health care, indicating a decline in the quality of health care over the period. The unparalleled data utilized in this study enabled us to conduct the first rigorous analysis of one of the most controversial healthcare reforms in England's recent history. While some have argued the Health and Social Care Act would improve the performance of health services by increasing competition, our finding adds merit to long-standing concerns it could instead lead to cost-cutting and poor health outcomes, says study author Benjamin Goddard of the University of Oxford. Sure enough, private profit-driven healthcare is more expensive and, in fact, leads to worse outcomes.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Unfortunately for the United States, we just tinker around the edges with healthcare, but here is at least some good tinkering happening on in Ohio. This from the Cincinnati Inquirer. Ohio expanded breast cancer screening coverage. Will the nation follow? For years, Michelle Young received regular mammograms, and for years those mammograms showed no signs of breast cancer. But in 2018, Young, a Brooklyn native who is now a lawyer in Cincinnati, was diagnosed with late-stage breast cancer. She was told she likely had had it since 2012. There was a problematic gap in the system, she had learned. I have dense breasts, and what I did not know or understand is that not only am I 5 times more likely to have breast cancer, but I'm also 40% more likely to have the cancer missed, Young said in an interview with the Inquirer. Dense breast tissue affects about 1 in 10 women, according to the Mayo Clinic. Just over 40% of women over age 40 and over have dense breast tissue show up on mammograms, making it harder to detect cancer. And in Ohio, many additional screenings outside of mammogram, including MRI imaging, weren't covered by insurance. That changed last week. Spurred by Young's advocacy, in which she convened physicians at University of Cincinnati Health, breast care cancer survivors, and Ohio State Reps Gene Schmidt and Cedric Denson, who co-sponsored the bill, Governor Mike DeWine signed House Bill 371, which requires insurance companies to cover additional screenings for individuals who are at high risk for breast cancer, into law. The bill will go into effect 90 days from its signing last Friday. Women of color in particular have 41% higher mortality from breast cancer than white women, according to the CDC. Removing a cost barrier for groups that experience other health disparities is a vital victory in the bill. Sarah Collins, Vice President of Healthcare Coverage and Access for the Commonwealth Fund, a nonprofit national healthcare think tank, said 12 other states have similar bills requiring coverage of additional screening, and a few others are currently working towards getting a bill done. It's pretty clear that additional screening for women with dense breast tissue is needed, Collins said. There is a widespread concern about screening, and the fact that Ohio has taken a step forward like other states have shows their concern about the issue and the desire to lower cost barriers for women. Young doesn't want to stop at Ohio, a state where bipartisanship can be rare. Since DeWine signed the bill into law, the lawyer said she's focused on getting more states on board and even working towards a push for a similar federal legislation using House Bill 371 as a blueprint. Well, go to it, Ohio advocates. Okay, well, lastly, we're going to report on some good news, some more healthcare news, a little bit of an expansion here. This from the Associated Press. California first to cover health care for all immigrants. California last Thursday became the first state to guarantee free health care for all low-income immigrants living in a country illegally, a move that will provide coverage for an additional 764,000 people at an eventual cost of about $2.7 billion a year. Governor Gavin Newsom signed a $308 billion operating budget that pledges to make all low-income adults eligible for the state's Medicaid program by 2024. Regardless of their immigration status. It's a long-sought victory for healthcare and immigration activists who have been asking for the change for more than a decade. Nationwide, federal and state governments joined together to give free healthcare to low-income adults and children through Medicaid, but the federal government won't pay for people who are living in the country illegally. Some states, including California, have used their own tax dollars to cover a portion of healthcare expenses for some low-income immigrants. Now, California wants to be the first to do that for everyone. About 92% of Californians currently have some form of health insurance, putting the state in the middle of the pack nationally. But that will change once the budget is fully implemented, as adults living in the country illegally make up one of the largest groups of people without insurance in the state. People living in the country illegally make up about 7% of the population nationwide in 2020, or over 22 million people, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. They are not eligible for most public benefit programs, even though many have jobs and pay taxes. Immigrants have slowly been getting access to some health care programs. 18 states now provide prenatal care to people regardless of their immigration status, while the District of Columbia and 5 states, California, Illinois, New York, Oregon, and Washington, cover all children from low-income families regardless of their immigration status. California and Illinois have expanded Medicaid to cover older immigrant adults. Healthcare advocates say that gap in coverage is significant for low-income immigrants living in the country illegally because they don't have other options. Citizens who lose their Medicaid coverage can purchase coverage from Covered California, the state-run health insurance exchange, and likely qualify for a significant discount. But for this population, that's it. Medicaid is the only public program available to them, said Sarah Darr, Director of Health and Public Benefits Policy for the California Immigrant Policy Center. Way to go, California. Okay, well, now we get the bonus article section of the show, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I reported on in this episode. I'll give you the link at the end of the list, 20 this week. Number one, how to have a medication abortion, where to find the pill and what to expect. Very detailed guide. Two, the abortion pill can be used later than the FDA says. It's used later and differently in many places. Three, big employers are offering abortion benefits. Will the information stay safe? Four, after Roe, Department of Health and Human Services guidance aims to keep health information secure. Five, anti-abortion lawmakers want to block patients from crossing state lines. And in a related but more broad analysis, six, there's another war between the states coming over abortion. Before the Civil War, northern and southern states did battle over fugitive slaves. Once again, something is legal in one state is illegal in the state next door. 7. Abortion pillmaker plans multi-state legal action to preserve drug access. Hopefully that'll work. 8. Abortion rights should be law, not a corporate perk. 9. Very interesting article. Indigenous tribes push back on calls to open abortion clinics on federal lines. 10. Catholic hospitals do not provide the same reproductive health options as other hospitals, including birth control. And 11. Men rush to get vasectomies after Roe ruling. Very effective form of birth control and one of the few that men can take charge of. So go to it. 12. The kids were already in crisis before Roe ended. With new abortion limits and bans, the pediatric mental health emergency will only worsen. Again, a very detailed, powerful report. 13. Another interesting study on racial bias and a very interesting study design. Placebo response reveals unconscious bias among white patients towards female black physicians. 14. Rural parents are less likely to say their pediatrician recommended COVID shots. Here's why it matters. So in urban areas, only 1 in 10 pediatricians don't go to the trouble of recommending COVID shots. But that's 4 in rural areas. So increasing those disparities between rural and urban areas. Another COVID story, somewhat. 15. Survey. Nearly half of physicians changed jobs during the pandemic. So you'd expect physicians or high income earners and higher status would be able to control their jobs a little bit more, but not in this healthcare system. And I really recommend this just as it's a very good detailed look at the landscape of how physicians are dealing with workplace issues. And 16, why LGBTQ adults are more vulnerable to heart disease. That's true with many disenfranchised populations. They're more vulnerable to the main causes of death, such as heart disease, cancer, etc. 17. Would carbon food labels change the way you shop? This is a very good article, and it also comes with a tool to compare different foods with their carbon footprint. 18. Another practical one. How to get rid of medical debt or avoid it in the first place. 19. Struggling with positive thinking? Researchers show negative moods can actually be useful. And related to that, and last but not least, 20, the joy of saving the world. Research suggests a surprising motive for environmentalism, feeling good. You can see these and all the other stories and previous shows at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice. Sweet.